It has been over 5 years since the United States Supreme Court ruled in favor of Citizens United, which abolished spending caps on political campaigns and ushered in a new era of corporate influence over politics. What happened in these first 5 years? Is it as bad as we feared? Gordon Lafer, author of the new book, The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time, says it's certainly not good, but not quite what we expected either. Gordon Lafer is associate professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. Again, the name of the book is The 1% Solution, and we welcome Gordon Lafer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this subject of wanting to look at this 1% solution?
Well, I think, you know, everybody knows that the country's in a crisis of economic inequality where it's gotten harder and harder for the majority of Americans to make a decent living. And people assume that politicians on both parties are working hard to try to fix that and maybe just disagree on how to do it. And I think what really struck me, and I think most people don't know, is that it turns out that one of the causes of growing economic problems for so many people in America is that the biggest and most powerful political actors in the country, which is the big business lobbies, are working night and day in almost every way in a very ambitious 50-state agenda to lower wages and make it harder for people to make a living by both by lowering wages directly and by lowering the kind of rights that people have on the job.
How much of this comes directly out of the Citizens United decision by the United States Supreme Court?
Citizens United had a huge impact. This was January 2010, and the court said that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money on politics. Now, politics was already skewed toward the rich, but this made a sea change both in federal politics but also state politics. In the state politics, the spending of the big corporate lobbies grew by 600% from before Citizens United and after, like from the 2008 to the 2012 elections. And it made a huge change in who got elected, and it made a huge change in what kind of laws were passed.
But with that said, this had been in the works for several decades prior.
That's right. I mean, it's not news to say the rich have more powerful and that people at the top have outsized political influence. That's always been true. But it's gotten much more extreme, just like, you know, the economy has gotten much more extreme, where the vast majority of people in the middle are having a hard time. Wages have gone down for 60% of men in America over the last 40 years. And then the 1% or even the 0.1%, people at the very top, have gotten astronomically rich. And what the Citizens United decision basically said is you can take that economic inequality and translate it into political inequality, because now you can spend as much as you want of that huge amount of money that people at the top have influencing what laws get passed.
So your analysis looks, in many cases, at the state level, legislative initiatives that happen in the first 5 years of Citizens United. Why is looking at what is happening on the state level so important?
First of all, the federal government has been mostly deadlocked. I mean, that may change now, but, you know, for the last few years, they could hardly agree on who to name a post office after, much less something more substantive. In the states, hundreds and hundreds of laws a year get passed, or thousands of laws get passed. The power of money in state elections goes farther, partly because state elections are cheap. Most legislative races you can buy with $50,000 or $100,000. Partly because almost nobody's paying attention. Most people in America can't name who their state legislator is. And that means that people with money and with interests have a much freer hand to remake the laws. That's happened in the state level primarily through something called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. ALEC is an organization that is made up primarily of several hundred of the biggest corporations in the country. And these are companies that everybody's heard of: McDonald's, Home Depot, GE, Ford, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, drug companies. And in ALEC, about a quarter of all state legislators are members. They pay $50 a year in dues. The rest of the money is funded by the corporations. They meet several times a year in committees that are made up half of state legislators and half of corporate lobbyists, where they write bills together that have to be approved by a corporate board, and then these bills get introduced in cookie-cutter fashion in state after state. And then the same companies that write the bills fund these candidates' campaigns, put ads on TV and radio, hire experts to write papers and appear on TV. So it's a very well-funded campaign. I think it couldn't happen in the Congress because too many people are paying attention to what happens in Washington, D.C., but because so many people are not paying attention to the states, they've been able to run this where we have bills written by corporate lobbyists introduced in all 50 states. And they estimate that they pass into law at least 200 of those bills a year.
I want to focus in on the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, a little bit. And you write that really you look at this, Wisconsin is a great example, Ohio is a great example. Give us a sense of a big victory for ALEC that came out of the state of Wisconsin and Governor Scott Walker's efforts.
Well, there have been a lot of them. The thing that is most famous about Wisconsin that most people know is early 2011 under Scott Walker when they basically stripped away the right to collective bargaining, union rights, from all of the public employees in Wisconsin. But even the fact of their being in office is partly a product of the companies involved in ALEC. Just a couple of months after the Citizens United decision, there was an organization put together, funded by big business, that said, we want to try to take over a string of state legislatures. And that money is what helped make Wisconsin have this right-wing legislature. But what also is telling is that in each when they attacked public employees and they did away with union rights for public employees, they said, we're doing this because we want to help the hardworking non-union taxpayers in the private sector who are being bled dry by Cadillac pensions of fat and lazy government employees, something like that. They said, we're not after the private sector unions. But after they had taken out the public sector unions, then they passed a so-called right-to-work bill that undermined the private sector unions. Then they passed laws lowering wages in the construction industry. Then they did away with the right to one day's rest in seven, which had been a law in Wisconsin. This is about non-union workers. And they made it illegal for any city to establish a right to paid sick leave. All of this stuff follows model ALEC legislation and was supported by the companies that fund that. So it's been very impressive, their power, and it's also important to see that it's not really about anti-unionism per se or anti-government. It's going after every type of worker, whether you're public or private, union or non-union.
So one of the numbers that you cite in the book is that 7% of the private sector is unionized. So you do have to ask yourself, why are the corporate lobbies so interested in going against that power when it makes up such a small piece of the pie?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's even a similar question is, why do big private corporations spend time, money, and energy attacking public employee unions in Wisconsin or Ohio? I don't think it's just because they want to pay less taxes. You know, one of the things that we see is that there was a Supreme Court case a couple of years ago, just before Justice Scalia died, that would severely undermine unions in the public sector. And one of the big corporate lobbies, the National Federation for Independent Business, put up something on its website explaining why it was spending members' dues, business dues, on a case about public employee unions. And what they said was, these public employee unions are the ones who are funding campaigns to raise the minimum wage and create a right to paid sick leave among our non-union private sector employees. So I think a lot of the attack on unions is not because of what they do for their own members, but because even in their shrunken and weakened state, the labor movement is the one significant political counterweight to these corporate lobbies having a completely free hand to remake the economy. And on a string of things, like they want more NAFTA-style trade treaties, they're against healthcare, they want a lower minimum wage, they want to stop importing cheap drugs from Canada, like a whole series of things that are not really union issues because they're things that union members have in their contract, but they affect the non-union economy, the 93%. On those things, the labor movement is the main obstacle standing in the way of the corporate lobbies just being able to do what they want. And I think that's why unions have been so much under the gun.
You write early on in the book, although it remains a thread throughout it, which you say it's very difficult often to differentiate and to understand what a corporate motivation is and may be, of what ultimately they are trying to do. Now, I guess, you know, it comes down to greed, right? but beyond that, of specifically what they're after is often hard to make sense of.
Well, you know, politics is not known as being the place where people speak the truth from their heart, right? It's a place of spin. But, you know, when we see something like ALEC or the Chamber of Commerce, this is not like looking at some individual billionaire who does something out of their personal ideology. These are all companies that at some point had a committee meeting and decided they think it's in their self-interest to put money into pursuing this agenda. And when you say, well, why do big private corporations want to defund education or defund libraries or defund mass transit? Some of it is about simple greed, like cutting public services so there can be more tax cuts for the rich and for corporations, and that's certainly happened in many states. But I think, you know, the scarier part that feels more dystopic is, I think for the people really at the top, the real elite, they look at America as an economy in decline, and they think that things are going to get worse here. And the question for them, the political question for them, is how do they grab even more of the pie, when make things even harder for the majority of people without provoking a backlash? And part of that is to lower everybody's expectations of what we think we can expect. If I feel like, okay, I don't have real health insurance, I only have catastrophic health insurance, but at least I have that, and for now I'm okay. I don't have any vacation days, but maybe I'll have time off between this job and the next. My kid's in a class with 35 kids, but at least it's not 45. Every time we ratchet down our expectations of what we think we have a right to demand, either from our jobs or from the government, that helps normalize downward mobility, helps prevent backlash. And I think part of their eroding all these government services is to do away with the idea that we should think just by being citizens, we have a right to affordable health care, or we have a right to decent education for our kids, or we have a right to be able to get to work on affordable public transit, things like that.
The subtitle of the book is How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. I would assume there are states that are better than others in fighting some of this.
Well, that's absolutely right. And, you know, for the most part, the place where the most aggressive elite corporate laws have passed are in states that are entirely controlled by the Republican Party, meaning both houses of the legislature and the governor's office. Although it's not a straight partisan issue, and I want to be clear that this is not a partisan book. It's not like Democrats are God's gift to working people, or that everything is one side or the other. But I also think that what we see is that legislatures pass laws, and people get elected to the legislature for all kinds of reasons, but on an issue-by-issue basis, the corporate agenda is very unpopular. You could see even in a state like Arizona, which is a very conservative state, last fall voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton by a significant margin, and by a much bigger margin, voted to raise the state minimum wage and create a right to paid sick leave. There are a lot of people who vote against the way their own legislators vote when they get a chance to vote on the issues.
So where does this bring us for the future, especially in this era of Trump?
Well, I think, for one thing, I think when we think what should we expect to be happening in Washington, D.C., and it's not just President Trump, but also the Congress and the Senate, which are filled with people who are backed by the corporations that are members of ALEC and the Chamber of Commerce. I think what we've seen in the states in the last 5 years really tells us what we should expect from Washington, D.C., and I think the most hopeful thing to think against that is what I was talking about before, which is that when people can organize not around candidates or around parties, but around specific issues, there's very broad and bipartisan support among both Republicans and Democrats for things like raising the minimum wage, having small class sizes, having affordable health care, even taxing the rich to make the country more equal. So I think that the most hopeful thing that I've seen as a way forward is in places where people have an opportunity to vote on particular issues, there's very strong popular support for a fairer economy.
Gordon Lafer is associate professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. The new book, The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. The book is published by Cornell University Press. Gordon Lafer, thank you very much for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The 1% Solution. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.